I am Iron Man.
This is a tasty burger.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Women in Session Podcast. Today, we are going to be chatting about Howard Hawks, the beloved old Hollywood director who was responsible for classics such as Red River, His Girl Friday, and Bringing Up Baby. My name is Zita Short. I am a writer for the publication, and today I'm joined by the wonderful Amy Thomason, who serves in the same capacity for the website and has also been a prolific podcaster elsewhere. So thank you for joining me, Amy.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
And getting into today's topic, we have wanted to do this for a long, long time. The scheduling has been a real problem. And I think part of it is the fact that this is a filmmaker with an extensive filmography. He was prolific. There are so many different eras that you have to cover. And so doing prep for an episode on this filmmaker is like cramming in the 3 hours the night before the exam. It's stressful. You feel as though you know nothing. And it's incredibly difficult to figure out what the parameters are. So I wondered for you, what's your background with Hawks? When did you first become aware of him? And why did you want to chat about him on the podcast?
Well, Howard Hawks is one of those greats of the classic era, and that he was doing movies in the 30s. I mean, up until, you know, I can't even think when he did the movie with Marilyn Monroe, The Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, that he had such a wide range of what he's famous for, that in some ways I always think of him with his screwball comedies, yet he also did some of the best Westerns ever made, which just seems like, who does that? And he did. And that he also had his own style with a certain kind of Hawksian woman, which I personally am a really big fan of. And he did a lot of things that filmmakers later took on. Like Robert Altman, I would say, is definitely influenced by Howard Hawks. I would say Aaron Sorkin is partially owes a lot to Howard Hawks as far as dialogue and the rapid people talking very rapidly and talking over each other. We think of it as Aaron Sorkin, it's such a modern idea. And it's like, well, not so much. It's been around forever if you know the correct movies to watch. And I agree with you. He's a hard director to cover because you want to do him justice because he really was so terrific.
Yes, he really was. And he's an interesting case because he is included in that pantheon of great directors. But I've always been fascinated by the fact that I can't really think of him as an auteur. And I think this is one of the weird things about the auteur theory. It's basically just, did this select set of critics like this guy? And in Howard Hawks' case, they really did, which is great. I think he deserves the recognition. But you can see them work really, really hard to pretend that he's an auteur in the same way that Hitchcock is, or Chabrol is, or Godard is. And I just think, say you're a film novice, say you haven't read all of the books that inform you of which films he made, you don't have Wikipedia open, I don't think that a person is going to point to Red River and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and immediately determine that they were directed by the same person. And yes, there's a bit of connective tissue there with these Hawksian women who frequently pop up, but I think of him as a filmmaker with incredible range, as you pointed out, and an ability to work in so many different spheres. And I guess it's one of the reasons why I hate the auteur theory, because I feel as though he should almost be classed as a journeyman, Because what he did, honestly, was he jumped from genre to genre. He worked with stars who had completely different images. He really just was the go-to guy for doing anything on the studio lot. And I think a lot of us would class that sort of filmmaker as a journeyman. He wasn't overly picky with the scripts that he was allowed to direct. And he really gave it a go with everything. And I don't think you can say that about a Hitchcock. I don't think you look at his filmography, as highly respected as he is, and think, wow, in 1941, when he attempted to make a romantic comedy with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, oh, he knocked it out of the park. No, you realize, maybe there's a reason why he went back to making thrillers. And that's fine. That was his genre. But Hawks exactly. is unique because he just seemed to get it whenever he took on a new genre.
Well, even how respected he was back in his day, because when I think of great Westerns, the first person I think of off the top of my head is John Ford. I mean, yes, he had The Quiet Man, but pretty much from 1939 when he did Stagecoach, The Searchers, all of the John Wayne movies. But one of my favorite anecdotes that the great Peter Bogdanovich said was when John Ford, the great John Ford, saw John Wayne in Red River, he was quoted as saying, "I never knew the son of a bitch could act." And this coming from John Ford, who directed John Wayne and everything. So for him to have said that is astonishing. And that even on the AFI genre list, wasn't Red River one of the top five best Westerns of all time?
Yes, I think Red River and Rio Bravo, which he also directed, are up there.
Exactly. So he was able to get these actors to really... To be their best. And I love the actresses, especially in his screwball comedies. And everyone's going to hear me talking about this a lot. But Rosalind Russell and His Girl Friday, what a woman. And adapting The Front Page, where her character is a male, where Hildy is a male character, and making it a romance, but not focusing on the romantic aspect of it. But she's a tough broad. And I love it. And the stage directions, the stage business is astonishing. And it seems so effortless that I can't imagine how hard it must have been to choreograph some of those scenes. You know, the scene at the beginning of His Girl Friday when she and Cary Grant are walking through the news office and there's keeps being those things that they have to open and shut as they're walking.
Yes.
So they're talking and I'm watching it. And of course, I saw it years and years ago and I didn't really think about it. But now I'm watching it. I'm like, that must have been so hard to hit those marks as they're speaking in that rapid dialogue without missing a beat. And how hard that must have been to do. It's just astonishing. There's so much in there. But it's just like I said, the staging of it is in that one scene where they're just walking from one side of the office to the next with this flow. Just incredible.
Right. It's so impressive that he managed to pull that off. And then you link it back to one of his earlier screwballs, Bringing Up Baby. And I would give Katharine Hepburn a lot of credit for making that movie what it is. She is a dynamo in that movie. If you're one of those people who thinks that, oh, Katharine Hepburn, she has her shtick, and she has very limited range. On some level, I agree with you. Yes, the accent always pops up, and you do get a lot of the same mannerisms and tics in every performance. But in this film, wow, this is a masterful comedic performance. This is not just an actress showing up and sort of playfully subverting her persona. This is someone who is doing the physical comedy. Who
yes, very much.
Chops. That scene where she and Cary Grant are trying to get away And they come across I think it's a shallow, or they think it's shallow, river. And she ends up jumping in. And it's hilarious. It's a perfectly executed pratfall. He has to pull her out. And the cherry on top of the cake is that she says, "Are we there yet?" After being pulled back out. And it's just a perfect encapsulation of what makes that character so charming. She is irritating. She is.
Yes, dizzy. She's and seriously
yet,
annoying.
Yes. And yet there's this sort of indomitable spirit that makes you like her, that endears you to her, and yes, you really want to see what she does next.
And when she loses, I love that whole bit where she loses the heel on her shoe, and she's still walking very quickly, but like she's bobbing up and down as she's marching around. And you think, oh, Katharine Hepburn, this queen, this goddess, and so formidable and so smart, and to see her play such a loopy character yet still intelligent is really astonishing, because I can't think of any. I mean, even in the Philadelphia Story, it's humorous, but it's a very different kind of humor. I mean, she is nuts in Breaking Up Baby and watching her get be in the lake and walking with the heel on, and then when the back of her dress gets torn and Cary Grant has to walk behind her and they're both walking like in sync with each other. It's so good. It's so good. And Howard Hawks really knew how to use Cary Grant, and that Cary Grant was never nominated for his comedy, because you think of him smooth and charming, but he also was very, very funny. One of the best.
Yes, I think he's very good at working with these movie stars. And we touched on this with another filmmaker a couple of episodes. It is something that I feel we don't really have anymore, this trend of certain directors essentially being able to work with every major movie star in the business, in part because movie stars just aren't the same anymore, but also because we don't have the studio system, and so you don't end up with as many weird, unexpected combinations as you might have gotten back then. But you think of something like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which we've already referenced, and I know it was seen as this trifle at the time, definitely a step down in significance from some of his other works, but it holds up so well and really is impressive on a screenwriting level as an example of a sort of subversive sex comedy where, yes, you do get to ogle the beautiful ladies and they wear these very revealing outfits. And yet the movie does provide them with a surprising level of agency, and something that if you've watched a lot of 50s women's vehicles, you will have noticed that it's depressingly rare for them to just have a friend that they hang out with, that they chat to about things that don't involve, "Oh, my husband tried to murder me last night and I'm having a with Rock Hudson now, so let's see how things work out." And this movie, even though they're both gold diggers, which is generally a sort of sexist stereotype, tends to attract the worst criticisms of women. The movie is surprisingly respectful of their bond, and it's probably, in my view, Marilyn Monroe's finest hour as an actress. It's the best use of that dizzy blonde persona that she built up. And you do get some delicious lines of dialogue towards the end where she's talking to essentially her Mark, the dumb, rich playboy that she wants to marry. And it's just hilarious. It really cuts to the core of the specific relationship dynamic. And I really wish that she had been given the opportunity to work with directors of this caliber more frequently. And I wish she had kept going with comedy, because this is really a huge achievement for her. I think if you're going to have a discussion about her acting talents, to me, this really has to be top of the list.
Oh, easily. And one of the most iconic things, her Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
Oh.
When I was a little girl when the Like a Virgin album came out with Madonna. So I saw the Material Girl video and was in high school and realized that it was based on The Gentleman's Prefer Blonde. And it's like, oh my gosh. Also never knew until I was older that it was a Broadway show that Carol Channing played that part. And very different, because Carol Channing is a very different actress than Marilyn Monroe. But Marilyn Monroe made it her own. And that's what we think of when we hear that song. And again, so different from such different characters than those strong Hawksian women.
Yes.
Because you look at Rosalind Russell, Katherine Hepburn, and then Barbara Stanwyck. Another strong, fierce woman.
If you wanted to make an argument there, you could say that Jane Russell is the typical Hawksian woman.
Yes.
She's this man-eater. She's very confident. She's very self-assured. And she's great fun to watch as well.
She really is. It's such a fun movie. And I gotta say, the costumes are to die for. To die for.
Yes, I agree. They're gorgeous. In their very gaudy 50s way, they really could have only been in fashion back then. And it's amazing.
Yes. I would wear all of them today. That pink gown that Marilyn wears with the gloves. And like I said, Madonna obviously paying a tribute to that much later on. And you would think, if you didn't know that Howard Hawks directed it, I would have thought maybe like a Vincent Minnelli or somebody, because it seems like that kind of a musical. Gorgeous gowns and singing and humor, yet it's not. It's Howard Hawks.
Yes.
Craziness.
It's one of the ones that you don't, or at least I don't look at and immediately think, yes, a typical Hawks project. But it's among his most highly regarded films. And I guess we should also get on to talking about Red River, which I know you've noted is the film in which John Wayne gives one of his best performances. When did you first see it? And why do you have such affection for it?
I watched it for when we did our Montgomery Clift episode. And why did I watch it? And why did I want to do the Montgomery Clift? Because I love Montgomery Clift.
Oh.
He is so beautiful. And I've said this before, Westerns typically are not my genre. There are a select handful of Westerns that I feel like just surpass mere genre. Like, I think Unforgiven is an incredible film. And I think Red River is an incredible film. That scene with Montgomery Clift and John Ireland. Do you know which scene I'm talking about?
Yes. With the guns and the...
With when they're comparing guns. And John Ireland, I was like, who is this handsome man? The chemistry with him and John Ireland in this movie, from the minute their characters are introduced, they are in love with each other. And I actually talked to someone recently who saw the movie and didn't pick up on the queer coding in that film. And it made me wonder, I don't know if I had seen it. And of course, I've watched The Celluloid Closet, where they've talked about all this and they pointed that scene out. And I'm wondering now, would I have picked up on it if I hadn't known to look for it before I saw it? But it's a great movie. But I will say that I wonder if I would have picked up on it earlier. But when you watch it and you look for it, you're like, it's really not that subtle.
No, it definitely isn't. And he would later claim that it was unintentional, But I think he was lying, because it's very difficult to watch that scene and to not imagine that they had planned for it to imply certain things, to have certain connotations attached to it.
And because it wasn't just that scene, it's the way they look at each other the entire film. You know what I'm saying? It's not that scene doesn't just exist in a vacuum.
Yes. It's a very interesting Western. Like you, I think I don't jump at the opportunity to watch a Western, even if it happens to be one of the more acclaimed ones. I remember when I was sort of trudging through the canon, as most neophyte cinephiles do, I had a hard time sort of working myself up to watch a lot of these Westerns. I really had to sit down and convince myself, no, Zita, you want to watch The Searchers. You do.
Yes, The Searchers. I was just thinking of that. I was like, The Searchers was such a, I do. You have to psych yourself up. Like, I'm going to sit and I'm going to watch this movie and I'm never going to watch it again. But yeah. Brutal.
So I think probably for that reason, I waited to watch Red River until later on, and I got to movies like Ball of Fire earlier on in my efforts to go through his filmography. And this one is interesting. I think it's seen as a minor work in his career when compared to some of the major classics. But Barbara Stanwyck in this film, so radiant, so impossibly charming. The fact that this came out in the year of the Lady Eve is just unfathomable. The fact that she was doing all that in 1 year.
I don't remember her being in Red River. Like, seriously.
What? No, she was in the Lady Eve.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
But she's just adorable in this movie. You love her immediately, as soon as she steps onto the screen. And the screenplay, which I believe was written by Billy Wilder. Yes, it was.
Of course.
Along with Charles Brackett, is very entertaining. So artificial in that classic Wilder manner. And one of the big conceits of the plot is that Gary Cooper's character is a lexicologist and he's working on an encyclopedia and he's trying to pick up street slang from the area. And so this is what makes the movie really enjoyable to watch as a period piece. You have this slang that would have been popular for a couple of years back then that almost immediately stopped being used in the post-war era, I assume. And so it's just fabulous. And Gary Cooper, he's not quite on her level. I think she is clearly the alpha in this situation.
That picture of her in Ball of Fire, where she's got her leg up in the air, so sexy.
Yes. Oh my
God. And she just, I always loved Barbara Stanwyck. I loved her all the way until 80, till she died, when she did The Thornbirds in the 80s. She is just a phenomenal actress. And speaking of the Lady Eve, she and Henry Fonda played very well together in that movie. I just need to get that out there because she's amazing. But, and she is such a good actress and yet not a typically pretty face and not really, I remember reading, she has kind of a strange body type, yet she knows how to work it. And Howard Hawks knew how to direct her. And of course, Billy Wilder can do no wrong. So she's just, it's just phenomenal.
Yes. And I'm also amused by the fact that the screenplay is a take on the tale of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I just found it so funny that Barbara Stanwyck does seem to be attracted to all seven of the dwarves in addition to Gary Cooper. And so that's, again, sort of amusing and definitely a bit naughtier than something that you would expect from a typical comedy from this time. So while I sort of agree with the critical consensus on this film, if you are a Barbara Stanwyck fan, if you want to see a woman be sexy on screen, this should be on your watch list. It is well worth seeking this out.
Definitely. And she did play a lot of risque roles, because the Lady Eve is also another one that's very naughty. There's very overt sexuality in it. And she is seductive and she is confident. And you can see these men just crumbling in her presence. And it makes me love her.
Yes. And I think you get even more of his great work with ensembles in this film. So many supporting players getting the opportunity to shine. And it reminds me of another one of his movies, Only Angels Have Wings, which is another one of the big ones, made it onto the Sight and Sound top 250 list in 2012. What do you think of this one?
I actually have not seen it. So I lean to you as often with a lot of these classic films.
Ah, so I was interested to hear what you think, because there's always a fly in the aspic. But I don't love this quite as much as I expected to. I think I love bits and pieces here and there. It doesn't quite come together for me in the same way that something like Bringing Up Baby does. And I came to the conclusion that there were just too many plot strands. I think what he seems to really delight in as a director is taking a very, very simple, streamlined story, typically as written in a screenplay, and then with the help of someone as gifted as Billy Wilder, he includes all of these non sequiturs and cutaways and longures in which nothing that contributes to the furthering of the plot occurs. You just sort of get to hang out for a bit and have fun and essentially relax. And Only Angels Have Wings, maybe it was just too plotty for my taste. I felt as though it kept getting in the way of the fun. Having said that, I'm very glad that there's a movie that features both Rita Hayworth and Jean Arthur.
Ooh. I haven't seen a lot of Jean Arthur. I think I've only seen like two of her movies. She's one that I need to explore more of her work.
Oh, she's wonderful. And seeing young Rita Hayworth is such an odd experience in a way, because like most people, even though I would describe myself as a big fan, I think I do tend to think of her as Gilda, because that is...
Of course.
And so seeing her as this sort of babe in the woods, in a sense, she just looks so young and innocent, is sort of disquieting at first.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's interesting for that reason. And then you also have The Big Sleep, another big one, another one that tends to rank up there in lists of the greatest films of all time. What do you think of this one? As someone who is not the world's biggest Lauren Bacall fan.
I'm not, which is why I haven't seen that one. I did start watching, I did watch To Have and Have Not. And it just hit me how much it was like Casablanca. I wanted to call it Casablanca Light. When they're at the beginning and they're in the bar and they've got the guy playing the piano, I was like, what? Is this Casablanca, but with Lauren Bacall? Crazy. But I thought that was pretty funny.
Mm. No, that's basically it. And it does remind me that Hollywood has always been making rip-offs of successful films. And I know that there are plenty of critics who advocate for this as a better film than Casablanca.
What?
I do not agree. I know that people love it because Bogey and Pakal are meant to be the sexiest couple who have ever appeared on screen. I kind of have the same problem as you. I think they have solid chemistry. I'm not one of those people who looks at these movies and thinks, well, I can take or leave everything else, but they are so good together, so undeniably brilliant, that this is a masterpiece. I just can't bring myself to feel that way.
I don't know why. I feel like I should. I liked, my favorite Lauren Bacall movie is the one, The Mirror Has Two Faces, that she did with Barbara Streisand much later in life. But it's just, like I said, in the first 10 minutes of the movie, when, you know, they're in Vichy France or France, and, you know, the piano player's playing and she gets up and sings, it just seems so awkward to me because I don't think of her as a singer. And no disrespect, she's not Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca. And I don't think a lot of Ingrid Bergman's character in Casablanca, but I think she, that soft focus that they shot her with looked really good. But I don't know what it is about Lauren Bacall. It almost takes me out of the movie because I feel like she's not as good as the other actresses of that generation. I don't know what it is. I'm going to get a lot of hate for this because I know a lot of people worship this woman, but she doesn't do it for me. And it's hard. It's hard to watch movies with her in it because she doesn't, I feel like, could they not get somebody better? Could they not get, you know, Stanwyck or Hayworth or Hepburn to play this part?
I think that's the thing, though, about this movie. It really is the epitome of a star vehicle in so many regards. And the thing about those movies is, if you don't love the star, then it can be pretty torturous to sit through a film that is entirely devoted to showing off the very specific quirks. And yeah, it's a hard watch if you don't want to be enchanted by her.
And Bogart, it's weird that I've seen him have better on-screen chemistry with other actresses.
Yes, yes.
I mean, he and Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen had scorching chemistry. And in Casablanca, you believe those two are really in love. But Lauren Bacall, it's, I almost wonder if it hadn't been Bogey and Bacall, I wonder if her career would have been different, because he was obviously capable of doing a lot without her. I don't know if she would have maybe been as big as she was without him.
No, I think most people would agree with that take. He was almost certainly a better actor, definitely had a more substantial career. At the same time, for him, I do think that relationship did a lot for his reputation as a celebrity, as this old man. Yes, you read about the fact that his relationship with his then wife, the woman that he cheated on with Lauren Bacall, received a lot of bad press. They were both alcoholics. They fought publicly a lot. He was constantly cheating on her. And then being seen with this sexy young actress on his arm apparently really helped to revitalize him in the eyes of the public. And I do think that the public fascination with their relationship helped the box office for those films and maybe even broadened his target demographic. Instead of just being the tough guy, he could be a sexy romantic lead.
True. I just feel like he had the Maltese Falcon, he had Church of the Sierra Madre, he had Casablanca, and I can't think of a Lauren Bacall movie that was as big as any of those films.
I think that's fair to say, but in her case, I think so much of it is to do with the look and the press coverage of her and her relationships. Yeah. And as an icon, you could almost argue that she is as big as him, even without the filmography to back it up. People recognize that face. They know the voice.
The voice, the face and the voice.
Yes.
And she did. And she had a very long life.
Yes.
And so we've seen her, and she's still, I think she looked better when she was much, much older. I think she's a beautiful older woman. Whereas when she was young, she kind of looked like everybody else. There wasn't really anything specifically unique about her.
She had that hairstyle, and you know. That face, though, I do think was somewhat unique in being so on the verge of looking masculine, really. So much of the emphasis back then was on looking very sweet and feminine and trying to avoid having one of those sharp angles that would make you look tough and manly. And there's something interesting about the fact that she almost has a rugged beauty, which is a descriptor that you usually apply to men. So I think that might have set her apart. I think part of the fascination, especially for people who learned about her later on, is the fact that someone who was married to Humphrey Bogart, who died in 1956, was still alive in the early 2000s and working with Lars von Trier, which is so bizarre in so many ways.
True.
So just for living her life.
Yes. And I loved her. And I love her in the Lars von Trier movies. I don't know. I love, like I said, Mirror Has Two Faces. She's hysterical in that movie. She is so funny. And in, Dogville. She was excellent. But when she's younger, it's interesting. It just doesn't do it for me. And that people forget, I mean, up until she died, she was Humphrey Bogart's wife. And you're like, you know, she was married after that too, right? She was married to Jason Robards. And but people forget about that. And she lived in the Dakota apartments in New York City. So she had that going for her too. But yeah. Hawks knew how to get really good performances out of his actors. John Huston, who we talked about last time, I feel got the best out of Humphrey Bogart, but Howard Hawks definitely worked well with him as well.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting to consider the fact that Hawks, despite the fact that he was married at the time when To Have and Have Not was in production, allegedly wanted to have an affair with Lauren Bacall. And when he noticed that she and Bogey were getting involved, attempted to intercede and told her, oh no, this isn't good for your career. And then, of course, she ends up sticking with Bogey. And I guess in that case, it does seem like she really did love him. It does not seem like it was a relationship that existed purely to further her career. So,
oh, no. Yeah. She definitely loved him.
Yes.
I didn't realize he died in 1956.
Yes.
Really?
So they had a very brief marriage, unfortunately. Yeah.
Brief, but I mean, he was literally doing great work until he died. Because you figure he got the Oscar in 1951. When did Sabrina come out? That was like mid-50s, wasn't it? 2 years
before his death, yeah.
Yeah, crazy. He couldn't have been that old. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was older than Lauren Bacall, who was what, like literally 19 in most of her movies?
She was 19 when she was cast in this movie, which is crazy to consider.
Because she definitely doesn't look it. She definitely looks like she's at least in her 20s. But women back then looked older. She looked like a woman. She did not look like the child that I looked like when I was 19 years old.
Yes, it's definitely a big change. And one thing that I wanted to consider, most of these actors that we brought up have either won Oscars or been nominated for them multiple times. Even Cary Grant, who everyone agrees was nominated for the wrong performances, at least got in there. Howard Hawks has one Best Director nomination, which seems crazy.
It seems insane, yes, because he's done some of those greatest movies of all times.
Mm.
But a lot of his best work wasn't successful when it came out. Bringing a Baby was a flop, yet is now revered. And His Girl Friday. The fact that none of these people were nominated for His Girl Friday is insane, let alone winning. I think Rosalind Russell should have won, but that came out in 1940, so that was a tough year. Still.
Right.
Game. Yes.
To me, it's still slightly confusing, because with most of these major Hollywood directors who were not recognized by the Academy, they work in genres that the Academy didn't appreciate. And so with Hitchcock, for example, I can sort of understand why, say, North by Northwest wasn't big with the Academy, even though it's seen as this classic now. Whereas with Hawks, a lot of these films are in genres that did manage to get nominations. It's not as though they completely shut out Westerns in the 40s and 50s. So it's
or comedies. Yeah. 1940, you had Philadelphia Story, and you had Cary Grant in Philadelphia Story and in His Girl Friday, and yet didn't get a nomination for either film. What?
Yes.
I can't. It's like baffling. And Rosalind Russell. So wrong in so many levels.
Yes, it's just an odd case. And the fact that the one nomination came for Sergeant York, which is one of his more forgotten films, is really disappointing. And I think indicates the limits of their imagination during this period, the fact that he can't get nominated for Bringing Up Baby, but this war propaganda film finally secures him the nomination. It's just disappointing.
It really is. And like I said, around that time, they were nominating comedies and they were nominating romantic films and Westerns. It's you would think with how revered these directors are that they would have gotten more nominations. And like Cary Grant, he only got one career nomination.
He got two. He was nominated
two. For
Penny Serenade and None But the Lonely Heart. Two movies.
Exactly. But who's heard of these films? And I remember I found this out listening to, I think, And the Runner-Up is when they did 1940, that Henry Fonda, the great Henry Fonda, who you and I are both madly in love with, was nominated in 1940 and then for On Golden Pond in the 80s, that somehow he wasn't nominated for anything else. And I was so angry when I heard that. But these people, so many of them, these great, great actors and great, great directors just totally got ignored. It's crazy. Crazy.
Hmm. Yes, it is an odd case to consider. And you also have the fact that while he was certainly well regarded or highly regarded in his time, his critical reputation has definitely improved over the years. And I think one thing that's funny that I keep coming across, and this is because I read sort of academic film criticism from the 60s, for example, you keep coming across these descriptions where critics are writing, oh, he's so underrated. And I think, well, no, that's not true. He has seven films in the Sight and Sound list or something crazy. But I guess back then, he was definitely seen that way. And so I guess for a while, he did struggle to get that respect.
Which is sad, because he really, really was great. And of all different genres. And I think that's that's the hard part when you have certain directors who can do several different genres, and therefore instead of their own unique style, and then don't get as recognized. I feel that's one of the reasons why we did our episode on John Hughes. Why John Hughes? I always want to say John Hughes. John Huston, excuse me, John Huston. That he didn't have those things that, oh, it's a John Huston film. Like Hitchcock, when you think, oh, the master suspense, there's going to be suspense in there. Or John Ford, he does the Westerns. Or George Cukor, he does the women pictures. When you get a Howard Hawks, it's like, oh, he does a lot of interesting films. And therefore, they don't get remembered as much. And it is sad. And more people should see their movies and appreciate them.
Yes, yes. And I do wonder whether it would be easier for normies to pick up his name, to understand how significant he is as a figure in Hollywood, if he did have some of those signature touches. Because I think there are plenty of people who know what an Alfred Hitchcock movie looks like and mm-hmm. what sort of plot it has without ever actually having seen one of them. They have almost certainly seen a clip from Psycho or
Rebecca. Shower scene.
Yes.
You hear the music from Psycho and you know it's Psycho even if you haven't seen the movie.
Yes, and I'm not entirely sure. With Hawks's films, in a way, you could say that the Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend scene might be the most iconic or best known scene in his filmography. And he didn't even direct that. So technically it's in his film, but he even gets robbed of that glory. And so I do wonder if there were maybe the Red River gun scene. We need to do more.
Oh, that's so funny.
Who knows that?
We absolutely do. I love it. But it's true. And I don't think a lot of people, when they think, even Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, I don't think people would watch them and be like, oh, that's right, that's Howard Hawks. It's
yeah.
Like when I found out that John Huston directed Annie, like, what?
Yes.
Crazy. Like, what? Mm. And then sometimes people just get misguided. There's people who think all Martin Scorsese has ever directed is gangster movies. And it's like, what? Okay, he did Goodfellas, which is a definitive gangster film, and he did Casino. But that's pretty much it. I mean, if you look at his filmography, he's done so many films, but people like to pigeonhole directors because it makes it easier. If you watch a Tarantino film, you know there's going to be a lot of cursing and a lot of violence. That you can say. Even if he does a Western, even if he does a modern film, there's going to be a lot of violence. Hmm. But Howard Hawks doesn't have that. And that is probably why he's not as remembered. In the same way that I would say John Huston isn't as remembered. Because they don't only direct one type of film.
Hmm. Yes, I think it really does help. If you want to be a household name, to have a reputation that's easy to remember or easy to rattle off, if there's some shorthand that people can use to understand who you are, even if they mm-hmm. haven't seen all of your films. And I'm not entirely sure that there is one with Hawks. And so maybe that doesn't benefit him or holds him back. But still, he's very highly regarded, as we've noted many times. And I think most filmmakers would kill to have that many movies ranked among the greatest of all time.
I completely agree with you. And I can think the only director that did a very wide variety of movies that was still respected, my guess would be Billy Wilder, because he did comedies, he did drama, he did a war film. You know what I mean? But other than that,
But I think even with Wilder, he has this reputation for, oh, well, all of his films, even if they have dramatic elements, have that comic edge. He's this master of dark comedy. He was mentored by Lubitsch. I think there's a real sort of connective thread that you can draw between all of those films. Even Five Graves to Cairo, his war movie, has those wilder touches. With Hawks, it's difficult.
Yeah, it is. We're going to have to do a series on Billy Wilder, because I feel like every week we mention how brilliant and wonderful and amazing he is. And he was. He was.
Yes. He's back here.
Howard, we love you.
Yes, we will not get sidetracked. But I'm just looking through now and talking about Howard Hawks films that you haven't seen does not sound
like, which is honestly a lot of them.
Doesn't sound like the point of the podcast. However, in his case, there are quite a few that I'm interested in getting around to. And a lot of them come from his early career. I know that he made a Louise Brooks buddy comedy called A Girl in Every Part. And the description of it is crazy, because the two main characters are womanizing friends who are both sailors, and they spend their evenings chasing after girls. And then, of course, Louise arrives on the screen and comes between them. But one of the major plot points is that one of the guys, played by Victor McLaglen, gives women giant back tattoos after they've had one night stands. And they apparently, even though they know they're not going to see him ever again, willingly consent to having this man's name tattooed on their back. And so Louise Brooks is stuck in this situation. And I just thought, what a crazy way. Instead of it being, oh, these women just reveal the fact that they slept with this guy once. No, there needs to be a visual indicator that he has slept with every woman in this town.
Oh, God. And Victor McLaughlin playing that part just makes it that much funnier.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
But even looking at some of these films, some of the lesser known ones, he made a Joan Crawford movie called Today We Live, which, even as a big Joan Crawford fan, I haven't been able to track it down. And then I think the big one that I haven't gotten around to is I Was a Male War Bride, where Anne Sheridan marries Cary Grant. I would love to see that one, because I adore her, and I think she doesn't get enough credit for being one of the great tough girls of old Hollywood. I think what Lauren Bacall is meant to be giving, Anne Sheridan is better at.
And wasn't she also in Scarface?
I don't think she was in that one. Anne DeVore.
I'm thinking Anne, that's what I'm thinking of.
But she is in Angels with Dirty Faces. That's her big.
Yes.
So I should really
try. I have to track down this movie about Victor McLaughlin and back tattoos. That's my new mission in life.
Yes.
And of course, Louise Brooks was in a body movie. Was she in anything else? Louise, we love you. Give us a call.
I know she has the two big German movies, obviously, that we all know, Diary of a Lost Girl and Pandora's Box. Mm-hmm. Looking through her Hollywood filmography. No, very limited filmography outside of that. Something called Beggars of Life from 1928. Oh, William A. Willman movie. Interesting. But no, didn't make many movies, but had a seismic impact.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have to admit, looking through, there is one film here that, even though people tell me it's great and I should watch it, I just have no desire to see. And that is Hatari, the John Wayne African safari movie.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-mm. 2 hours.
I'm not a huge John Wayne fan.
2 hours and 37 minutes long.
What? No, that's entirely too much. Give me The Quiet Man. I think that's his best role.
Yes, I'm not a huge fan. I just, I kind of can't stand him, and it's really frustrating.
No, I agree. But I like The Quiet Man, and I think 99% of it is because, no, let me see. 97% of that is the supporting cast in that film, and then Maureen O'Hara. But that support, Barry Fitzgerald's in that movie is a stitch, and that fight at the end. Now we're getting into John Ford, but but John Wayne, not a big fan.
Yeah.
Because I'm also not a big fan of Western, so it fits.
Yes, and he definitely, he just gets on my nerves. And yes, he's in all of these canonical classics. Do not try to convince me that that man is a good actor. Don't you dare. He had so many swings at the bat, and the fact that he gave good performances, let's say 3% of the time, doesn't count for much. There's still a lot of crap in there.
The fact that John Ford said until Red River, he never knew the, and I quote, son of a bitch could act, kind of says it all. If John Ford doesn't think he was that great of an actor, that's it. The conversation's done. He was an archetype, and he was good. He was good at what he was good at the few things he was able to do. I'll give him that.
I think the problem
because is he's so much of an icon in our country.
Yeah.
Like you say, John Wayne, it's a shorthand. Manly, alpha male, swaggering cowboy.
Yeah, that's the thing. I just despise that image. I just find him so obnoxious on screen. But oh well, Howard Hawks worked with plenty of leading men who were not John Wayne. Fortunately, so you can avoid him a lot of the time, and that is
yes.
Pleasant. But I wondered, have you written anything about Mr. Hawks for the site, and what are your summative thoughts on his filmography?
What I believe I put Cary Grant in for a why was he not nominated for. Maybe for His Girl Friday, that might have been it. But that would be my thoughts, is that he directed some of these people in their best roles. I love Cary Grant, His Girl Friday. I think he should have been nominated and possibly won. Oh, wait, that was 1940. Sorry, that's my Henry Fonda's year. But Rosalind Russell, His Girl Friday, 1940, absolutely should have won. And it also should have been nominated for Best Picture, which is crazy to me. But he definitely deserves to be remembered. I know I need to definitely see more of his films than his basic starter pack. But he definitely deserves a place in the pantheon of great, capital G, great directors in American cinema.
Yes, and I think fortunately he has ascended to that level. And I completely concur with everything that you've said. I think it's wonderful every now and then to discuss a director that we have this unabashed admiration for. And I think we both really admire him. So combing through his filmography, discussing some of our favorites was good fun. And yes. Right before we go, I guess I should ask, what is your favorite Howard Hawks film?
His Girl Friday. Because I just see it as so influential. Like I said, if you watch an Aaron Sorkin film or anything that Aaron Sorkin directed where they're walking and they're having a conversation and there's that rapid dialogue, that's straight out of His Girl Friday. And Robert Altman, with people, the rapid dialogue and people kind of talking over each other with a lot of action going on. He was a lot more influential, I think, than people even realize. And he was special. He had these great female characters that were smart and funny and strong and independent, and yet also had great chemistry with the men in their lives. And the world could use more directors like him. And I like that he branched out and didn't pigeonhole himself into romantic comedies. Because if not, then we wouldn't have Red River, which is actually a good movie and very entertaining. So if you're not into Westerns, see that one. Also because John Ireland and Montgomery Clift are very good looking. It needs to be said. And if you look up Red River Gay on YouTube, you can find the scene we're talking about, people at home.
Yes, you definitely can. Just go to YouTube, look it up. So much sexual tension and chemistry. And
yes,
I'm amazed that they snuck it in there back then.
But when you're Howard Hawks, you get to do things like that and be a little naughty.
Yes, you do. And in terms of my favorite, gosh, this is difficult, but I think I ultimately come down on Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I think it might be the most complete realization of his comedic vision. And you have so many memorable visuals from the movies, great script. It's perfect in terms of its length. It's so brief that you don't have time to notice how soft and fluffy it can be. And I think it really is the perfect chick flick in a way. It's great to watch with a group of female friends. And I do not say that about many sex comedies. So
you definitely do not. And you've got Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe at their best. They look amazing. Oh, and they're funny, and the costumes are to die for. It's just so many good things that we love.
Yes, I just adore it. So I would recommend that you pull that movie up and watch it if you haven't seen it yet. I think there are very few people who haven't seen at least one or two things from it. But no, that's wonderful. And it's been really great to chat about him. And I just wondered, Amy, where can people find your writing on the site? Are there any pieces of yours recently that you'd like to highlight?
The Seriously Red review was posted last week. I'm currently brainstorming ideas for my next piece. I've got a couple ideas percolating. Get it written soon. And you can find me at athomason11 on Twitter.
Yes, so definitely check out everything that Amy's been getting up to. The Seriously Red review was great. It was in the incubator for a while, and I think the extra effort really comes through. It's a great review.
Thank you.
And
it's everything because Zita's fabulous.
Oh, thank you. I'm also on the site. I've written a couple of pieces, especially about romantic dramas. And I wrote a piece about bringing up baby at one point. So I'm a big fan, obviously. And you can see me expound on Katharine Hepburn's brilliance in that review. And I'm also on Twitter at Zita_short. So if you want to check us out, just head to those platforms. And thank you so much for listening today. Amy and I were a little bit worried beforehand because the wonderful Kristen Battistella was not on hand to steady the ship when we headed into rough water. But I think things went rather well.
And yes.
I hope that you've enjoyed listening to this episode.